What's one thing you as a parent can do to help your children get more sleep, do better in school, behave better, and experience other health benefits? The answer? Limit screen time. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Kids these days average more than 6 hours of screen time per day. In the first half hour, I'll talk with Iowa State University psychology professor Doug Gentile about his new study analyzing the media habits of more than 1,300 school children. Then public policy expert Pete Damiano reflects on the Obamacare deadline we passed at midnight. And finally, why food labels are being overhauled for the first time in 20 years. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now, here's something comforting to those of us who are raising a family. You as a parent may not always see it, but your efforts to limit your kids' screen time can make a difference. That's according to a new study published in JAMA Pediatrics. It found that limiting screen time can have a host of beneficial effects. Children get more sleep, they do better in school, they behave better, and they experience other health benefits. This happens when parents limit content and the amount of time their children spend on the computer or also in front of the TV. To find this out, researchers analyzed the media habits of more than 1,300 school children who were recruited to participate in an obesity prevention program. Douglas Gentile is the lead author of this study. He's associate professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Doug Gentile, welcome back to our program.
My pleasure.
What did you set out to do in this study?
Well, originally the study was designed, as you mentioned, as an obesity prevention program. We had an intervention called the SWITCH program, which is still running in Cedar Rapids, actually. And it was designed to get kids to increase their fruit and vegetable consumption, decrease their screen time, and increase their physical activity. And it turns out the intervention worked pretty well for that. But as part of measuring how well it worked, we gathered a lot of information from kids, from teachers, from parents, and we realized that there was more in there that we could learn than just how well the SWITCH program worked.
Mm-hmm. So what were the biggest surprises for you?
Well, there were a couple. One, in a paper we published before this, we actually looked at, do parents and children agree on what they see as far as parents monitoring their screen time? And so we asked a couple different ways, whether kids, whether the parents set limits on how much time they spend, whether parents set limits on the content, whether parents discuss the content with them. And the funny thing is, parents and children pretty much never agree.
Imagine that.
And yet, they both were accurate predictors. There's the really surprising thing.
Accurate in what way?
Well, even though the kids didn't report the same behaviors that the parents did, when you use these to predict, say, like school performance, something we know is correlated with screen time, both the parent report of how much they monitor the child and the child report predicted it equally well.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that parents and children perceive the monitoring a little differently, but they're both pretty accurate. That, parents know what they're saying, and children know what they're hearing, but they may not be identical.
Uh-huh. So where is the crux of the disagreement, then?
Well, we don't know the answer to that. I think it's that, if you think about it from, the parent's side, the parent kind of knows, in her head what rules she wants to have. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we ask a parent, what rules do you have, the parent, probably can tell us those very, very accurately. The child, on the other hand, knows when there have been disagreements. That's what's most salient to the child, when the child wants to do something and the parent doesn't allow it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the child may not know the overall rule very well, but does know when they've, bumped up against it in some way. And so they may actually see these in slightly different lights, but they're still really accurately reporting on the same thing, even though they don't report the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know parents make their rules usually very clear, so that the kids are in a way sort of in a denial about the rules or trying to be denying them.
Well, we're not sure about that. I mean, the kids do report that their families have rules, but it's not always the same rules the parents report. Either reporter actually seems to be equally accurate in terms of whether those rules are effective.
Let's talk about this latest study. I understand it's sort of a ripple effect that you found here. When parents limit screen time, it can make a difference in a whole host of areas. Explain what you found there.
Yeah, so we followed these kids across the whole school year, so from the beginning of the school year to the end of the school year. And we find that, parents who set these limits, who are more actively engaged in children's media habits, later on, at the end of the school year, so 7 months later, we find that the parents did lower the screen time, lower also violent media exposure if they were particularly focused on setting limits around types of content, and that those in turn increased their sleep 7 months later, improved their school performance, lowered their risk of obesity, increased their positive pro-social, helpful, and cooperative behaviors, and lowered their aggressive behaviors. And what's surprising is those aren't the same type of outcome. Those are really different things. Those are social outcomes and physical health outcomes and intellectual and school performance outcomes. Those are really wide range of different health and wellness effects for kids. And the parents probably can't see it, because when you're setting a limit on how much time your kid can play video games, you're not going to notice 7 months later that their sleep has improved. Mm-hmm. And you're certainly not going to notice if they're less aggressive than they otherwise would have been. And so parents often feel out of control when they're thinking about, their kids' media habits, because, the kids are often, more facile with the new technologies. But this shows that parents really are in a much more powerful position than they realize.
Explain, let's take these a little bit one by one. Explain the impact on sleep and why that should change by limiting screen time.
Sure. Well, we don't know exactly what's happening in each of these households, but we do know the average amount of time kids spend in front of a screen is way more than the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends. The AAP recommends no more than 1 to 2 hours of total screen time, and by total screen time they mean add up television, movies, DVDs, video games, handheld video games, iPad, Facebook, all the entertainment use of screens. School use is free. That doesn't count in it. But add up all the entertainment use, it should be no more than 1 to 2 hours a day. And they mean the 1 hour for elementary school age kids, which are what these children were in this study, or 2 hours for secondary school age children. Well, the average child in America is well over 6 hours of screen time a day. And so when we think about how much free time do kids actually have in a week, 6 hours a day is, almost all the possible time there is after school and before mm-hmm. bedtime. And it must, in fact, be kind of pushing the bedtime back a bit as kids nowadays, take their cell phone in their bedroom with them and their friends are still texting them. And so you think they're in there sleeping, but they're actually spending a little more time awake than you might imagine. And we know that sleep is important for a wide range of things, that with greater sleep comes better ability to focus, better ability to remember what you learned in today. It's important for physical health, for getting back at from whatever you did in the day, but also for things like risk of obesity. And that's also what we found, is that the kids who improved their sleep because of this study also reduced their risk of obesity 7 months later.
Let's talk a little bit more about the aggression, the behavior problems that seem to have been limited by limiting screen time.
Yeah, these were limited partly by screen time, but in fact they were more, the change here was made more by parents who set limits on the types of content their kids could watch. So using the ratings, perhaps, to try to decide whether this is appropriate for your child, pre-screening them and saying, well, if it has a lot of violence or a lot of sexual imagery, then you know it's not appropriate. And we're talking about third to fifth graders here, so most parents would not usually think that those were appropriate for that age group. But some parents put stricter limits on it than others, and we find that when parents do set those limits, it shows up in kids' behavior 7 months later, that they ended up being less aggressive with their peers and more pro-social. And in another study we recently released, we're starting to understand why that happens. The pro-social behavior is as kids consume more kind of what we might think of as family-friendly or pro-social media, they actually learn to learn better empathy. And that then shows up in their behavior. Whereas if they're watching a lot of violent media, they practice a lot of violent ways of thinking, and then we know how you think can show up in how you behave.
Let me voice some criticism of your work that I found on the internet, actually a website perhaps you're aware of called GameRant.com, which seems to like to look at your work and your colleagues' work at ISU. Specifically on the attitudes, of course, gamers have an interest in defending their way of life, so to speak. They say, could it be just as easily the case that children who were more aggressive were more likely to take an interest in playing violent video games, so that you have this subset going to violent video games who are already aggressive?
That's actually very true. Children who are already more aggressive do seek out more violent media. The issue is it still makes them, it reinforces all of those aggressive attitudes and ways of thinking, which, makes them more aggressive. But we also find that kids who aren't naturally aggressive, if they play these types of games, they also start to become more aggressive. And in the most recent study we released a week ago, we tracked 3,000 children for 3 years. And so we know what came first. And we actually can show in that yes, although aggressive children do seek out more media violence, their later aggressive behavior did not, happen before earlier violent gameplay. The earlier violent gameplay actually predicts their later aggressive behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we do know that, yes, kind of both of these things happen, that kids seek it out, and it can change the way they think and feel and ultimately behave.
What about this possibility? Do we know if for some children violent video games may be a catharsis for aggressive feelings, a way to let out these feelings without hurting anyone, sort of the digital equivalent, Doug, of say, hitting a wall or going out into the woods and yelling to vent frustration? Do we know that's not the case?
Yeah, unfortunately we do. It's a really elegant idea. It's something I wish were true. But there are now hundreds of studies, all of my studies on media violence, for example, the kids could end up being less aggressive after it. They just don't tend to be. And we also know from studies specifically trying to demonstrate catharsis that it really doesn't work. There was one of the classic studies also was performed here at Iowa State by one of my colleagues, Brad Bushman. He actually angered people, had them randomly sign, some of them punched a punching bag, some of them punched it while thinking of hitting the person who angered them. So that's the normal catharsis idea, that we're getting it out in a safe way. Some of them he had hit it while thinking about getting physically fit, so that would be kind of distraction. And a third group he had just sit there and do nothing for a couple of minutes. And then they were given an opportunity to actually behave aggressively toward the person who had angered them. And the ones who hit the punching bag were actually the most aggressive, because what you're doing is you're actually reinforcing these aggressive feelings and thoughts rather than learning a new way of coping with these, with anger that doesn't involve thinking about hitting someone, finding a way to resolve things without kind of displaying your anger. And so catharsis is a great idea. It just doesn't actually happen. It feels like it does. And here's the interesting thing. We believe it because after you've played video games, or say a violent video game for 2 hours, when you're done, you feel really tired and you feel really relaxed. Why is that? Well, it's because for that 2 hours, you've been kicking on your sympathetic nervous system. So in the face of these, you know, the violence, kids talk about the adrenaline rush they get from a violent game, and they're absolutely right. It is adrenaline and noradrenaline and cortisol and testosterone. These are the stress hormones that your body would produce if you were actually in a real fight. Now, the stress system was designed to be an acute system where the tiger is chasing you and you need all that extra energy for about 5 minutes to either fight it and run away or you're dead. It was never meant to be kept on for 1 to 2 hours. And so by playing the game for that long and keeping your stress system on for that long, at the time you turn it off, you are dead tired. Your body has been working overtime to try to keep you alive. Even though it's just a game, your body actually treats it like a real fight. And your body just, you know, kind of needs to relax at that point. And that feels like, oh, I must be less aggressive. But in fact, it turns out if your brother came into the room right then and insulted you, you'd be more likely to hit him.
Mm-hmm. Your body's tired out, except for the muscular part of your body. Oh, I guess excepting the thumbs and the fingers, because as you mentioned with a link to obesity, we don't get any exercise here.
Yeah, and that's one of the sad things is that, you know, to some extent, it's the same type of physiological stressor that exercise is. It also raises not all of those same hormones, but some of them. But those hormones are designed to kind of help your body perform better and, you know, use energy efficiently, but you're actually not using any. And mm-hmm. so in a sense, you're just stressing your body without the actual benefit of the exercise.
Doug Gentile is my guest this half hour, if you've just joined us. He's the lead author of a new study that's been published in JAMA Pediatrics that found that limiting screen time can have a host of beneficial effects. Children getting more sleep, doing better in school, behaving better, experiencing other health benefits. Does it matter, Doug, what's on the screen? Let's say, okay, we limit screen time. Does it matter what's on the screen, schoolwork versus surfing the web or YouTube or Facebook?
Well, the answer is yes, but we don't know all of the answers to what matters in what ways. If kids are using screens for their homework or for doing research for a paper, then that, you know, that's okay. That's actually probably beneficial. If kids are watching educational television or playing educational video games, we also know from many years of research that those actually have powerfully beneficial effects. If they're watching things where people take care of each other and care about each other's feelings and are kind to each other, kids, kids are fantastic learners. We can learn just from watching someone else do something, and so we learn those types of attitudes and behaviors. And if we watch, if kids are watching violent things, then they learn those types of attitudes and behaviors. So the content matters greatly, and this is why I never tell parents, oh, you should throw out your TV, because then you're throwing out all the benefits as well as the potential harms.
How should a parent go about limiting screen time? Do you have any research over the years about how to do it? Because this is a constant point of frustration, is to find some sort of mechanism. And you talked about that the child and the parent can agree on that this is the way we plan things, and we believe this is a good way to limit screen time.
Well, let me give you two answers to that. First one is there are four types of ways parents can monitor kids' media. And three of them have really beneficial effects, and one actually can have a surprisingly harmful effect. And so you can limit the amount of time on screens. You can limit the content of time on screens. You can do what's called active mediation, or actively discussing the content. So parents talking about with their kids about why is it portrayed the way it is? What does it mean that it's portrayed that way? Why did they show you this point of view? What are they trying to get you to feel? What effect do you think this has on the viewers? Get kids to kind of see behind the curtain to understand, why the media are constructed the way they are. And the fourth is, just simply co-viewing. Sit and watch with them or play the game with them. It turns out co-viewing alone actually enhances all the negative effects of the media, because then you're giving your approval just by your presence that everything you're seeing must be okay. So if you're going to sit and watch with your kids, it's really important that you do the discussion, the active discussion with them, and then that mitigates almost all of the negative effects, and it also enhances the positive effects of the media. So the active discussion actually turns out to be the most powerful thing parents can do, but it's not something most parents do intuitively. If they discuss the media with their kids, they usually do it in a way of just saying what they like or don't like or give their opinions, but in fact it's much better done with questions, asking the kid for their opinion about what they, you know, why they think things are the way they are.
Mm-hmm. So try to limit to 1 to 2 hours a day and as much as possible discuss.
And how can you do that? Let me answer that. One way that parents have found that's useful is you set up kind of an allowance for them. You could give them tokens or coupons for, say, 10 hours of screen time a week, and you let the kid pick what 10 hours they use. You know, do they dole it out a little every day, or do they save it up and have a big binge on the weekend? It's very similar to what we do with, say, a monetary allowance, where we want kids to start learning to have some control over it themselves, certainly by the time they're 18 and go off into the real world. We don't give them money because we think they deserve money. We give them money because we want them to learn how to handle it. Well, we could also give them a screen time allowance and let them learn how to figure it out. If they blow it all at the beginning of the week and then wish they had some at the later end of the week, well, that's just the natural consequence of not really thinking ahead. And so kids would learn over time to actually manage it much more themselves.
Mm-hmm. How do you hope these findings in this latest study will be used, Doug?
Well, I'd like a couple things. One is parents do often feel out of control. They often don't feel like they're just fighting a losing battle all the time, as the kids are constantly pushing back, and they don't see that they're holding the line really is helping anything. And I think these results show that even if you can't see it, it's still actually having a really powerful effect. You know, no one is going to notice a year later that, you know, my kid is getting better grades than they otherwise would have gotten. And even if they notice that the grades have gone up, they're not going to say, oh, it's because I was limiting screen time a year ago, even though we're finding that's true. And so I think it's important that parents realize they may not notice any immediate or even long-term effects, because we're talking about tiny little changes that just accumulate over time, that snowball rolling down the mountain. And therefore, they're actually having a much greater effect than they realize. And so they should continue to hold the line. You know, children's job is to try to break the rules, and parents' job is to hold them firm.
Okay, very good. I'll leave you with this. While researching this area today, I found this study kids are not the only guilty ones for overdoing it on screen time. A new analysis by researchers, I'm sure you've seen at the Boston University Medical Center, did this in pediatrics, explored caregivers' use of mobile devices around children during mealtimes. Out of 55 observations, only 18 did not use their mobile devices. So only a third of those observations at mealtime were with parents, caregivers, who did not have some sort of mobile device with them, so the children were left to entertain themselves or make bids for their caregivers' attention.
Yeah. It's interesting when you go out to a restaurant, you can see this all the time. Not only do the parents, you know, pull out their phones, but then they hand them to the kid to entertain the kid, because kids have come to expect that kind of constant stimulation, which is part of why we're seeing trouble with attention problems in the classroom, because the teacher doesn't have that same type of flicker and budget for special effects that the iPad has.
Doug Gentile, always a pleasure to speak with you. Lead author of a new study published in JAMA Pediatrics that looks at limiting screen time. Doug Gentile is Associate Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University. Thanks, Doug.
My pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, public policy expert Pete Damiano reflects on the Obamacare deadline we passed at midnight, and we'll find out why food labels are being overhauled for the first time in 20 years. Back after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, how much do you pay attention to food labels? Do they make sense? Do they help you make better choices? Well, in just a moment, we'll find out why food labels are being overhauled for the first time in 20 years. But first, healthcare.gov, that's the portal for people signing up for insurance on the exchanges, closed down overnight and now is closed to people trying to set up new accounts. Yesterday, more than 4.8 million people visited healthcare.gov. More than 2 million calls were registered to the call center. Now, if you missed setting up an account, you'll have to wait until open enrollment starts for 2015. That's in November of this year. A final surge of health insurance signups may have sent the number of new enrollees to the 7 million mark. That's important because that's the original estimate for the new Obamacare marketplaces. Joining me now, public policy expert who's been helping us understand changes in healthcare under the Affordable Care Act, Pete Damiano, director of the Public Policy Center and professor in the Department of Preventive and Community Dentistry at the University of Iowa. Pete, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you were with us when healthcare.gov opened for business and had that abysmal launch due to technical errors last fall. What are your reflections on the national picture the day after enrollment closes?
Well, as you know, our role is to study the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and other issues related to healthcare rather than as an advocate. But it is interesting, you know, at that time, it looked like it was just going to be a total disaster and people would lose confidence. On the other hand, you may recall we were reflecting on what was happening in Massachusetts back in 2007 when they started their RomneyCare, Obamacare type of plan. And we were talking about then about how toward the end is when enrollment spiked tremendously, and we were expecting that to happen once they got through all the technical issues, but you never really know for sure. And now it does seem, at least for this first round, that that did happen. You have a lot of, you know, just natural human behavior. People aren't sure about this, put it off to the end, and then seek it out. But there are still a lot of challenges ahead.
Mm-hmm. What would those challenges be that you see?
Well, from some of the research that we have done, as well as others, when you're looking at the people who are most likely going to be eligible for either the health insurance through the health insurance marketplace, the subsidized private insurance, or the Medicaid expansion in Iowa, the health and wellness plan, these are people that are the least knowledgeable about the Affordable Care Act. They have the least experience with health insurance, period. They're the least computer savvy, and it certainly helps to have that computer savvy when you're looking at trying to enroll for the most part online. There are some other options now. And so this is the group that's really hard to reach. So while, you know, it's very successful that they've reached the 7 million through both the federal exchange and the state exchanges, and then somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 9 million are the numbers that I have seen in terms of through the Medicaid expansions in the states that did do it, you know, there's still room for growth in the next few years. And I think it is going to be a multiple year so that people see what it is, get comfortable with it, hear a neighbor that maybe had, you know, success getting a plan through the marketplace or through the Medicaid expansion and then trying it themselves.
Pete, let's focus a little bit more on Iowa. What can you tell us about Iowa? But first, perhaps remind us the path that Iowa chose to approach the Affordable Care Act.
What Iowa opted to do is have a joint approach where we're using the federal marketplace, but the state took responsibility for setting up enrollment, approving the plans, and things like that. So we took a hybrid approach. On the Medicaid side, the Medicaid expansion has two pieces of it. Together, they're called the health and wellness plan. And then for the lower income, up to 100%, that's the wellness plan part. That's called the Iowa Wellness Plan. And that's primarily a Medicaid-type expansion with some healthy behavior incentives and a little bit slightly different approach. And then from 100 to 133%, they're going to be going into the health insurance marketplace and purchasing, or not actually purchasing, being able to get private insurance through the marketplace.
To make sure people are clear, if you didn't sign up but still want to, you have to wait till November?
You have to wait for November on the private insurance side. But on the public insurance side, my understanding is that will be rolling throughout the year.
Okay. And finally, Pete, what predictions, what expectations do you have for further adoption of this highly controversial, highly politicized health care law? Are the negative headlines gone, you think? Glitches in the past?
Well, right. You can't talk about this without at least acknowledging the politics of it, obviously. With the midterm election coming up in the fall, it's clearly going to be tried to be used as an issue from both sides. So I don't think you're going to, you know, hear it go away. Both sides are trying to figure out how to sort of posture, given there still are challenges, but yet it has pretty successful for quite a few people.
Okay, and the politics of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, will be one of our topics tomorrow on Politics Day. Pete Damiano, Director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa, thanks for letting us check in with you.
You bet. Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The ubiquitous nutrition label on food packages is getting its first overhaul in 20 years. Now, the new label is not out yet. It could, in fact, take a year or more to appear on store shelves. It includes, though, more than a half dozen significant changes that advocates see as a key in fighting the country's obesity epidemic. Joining me now to talk about these labels, nutritionist Ruth Litchfield, associate professor and associate chair of food science and human nutrition at Iowa State University. Welcome back to our program, Ruth.
It's great to be here.
So what are the biggest changes that we'll notice whenever these labels come out?
Well, as you said, there's actually quite a few changes, and I would say the biggest one that folks are going to notice is that the calories on the Nutrition Facts label are front and center. What I mean by front and center is they're in a much larger font. They're in bold print so that I don't think you can miss them. So that is, to me, probably one of the most significant changes is the fact that the calories is really large and dominant on the new label. And that is, as you said, directly related to our number one health problem today, and that is obesity, which is leading to a lot of chronic disease in this country.
Before you go on to the other changes, let's stick with that and do some explaining as to why the calories have to jump out at us, why that's deemed to be much better.
Well, in the past, the Nutrition Facts label, the calories were in the same, you know, size font and in the same style as everything else. And, you know, a lot of consumers have complained that, you know, the Nutrition Facts label is a bunch of numbers. It's a lot of information and it all looks the same. Because we know that obesity, weight management is our number one problem, and it's not been successful. You know, the information that has been provided obviously is not working because we're continuing to have this problem. It's still growing in many populations, so we needed to make a change. The other thing, though, that kind of relates to this is the serving size. When the Nutrition Facts labels were first initiated in this format back in the mid-90s, the serving size was established as what was the recommended serving size, not what are people actually eating, but what is a recommended serving size of various items.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's changing as well.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between the recommended and what people are actually eating? We're actually eating much more?
We're actually eating more than the recommended. So the calories that are now front and bold are going to be much more in line with what people are actually eating, not what they should be eating. So it's going to be much more, it's going to be easier for consumers to say, oh, yeah, I'm eating that number of calories, because we found that the serving size is a real difficult concept for them to understand.
Mm-hmm. How is that going to be communicated? Because then we have a new serving size. People will just think it's the old serving size. How will we go through that transition?
And that will take some education. Folks like myself, nutrition educators, dietitians, extension professionals will be doing some education about what these new labels mean. But just the fact that the calories now stick out, you know, people weren't paying attention to the serving size in the past anyway. They just assumed whatever the calories were on the label, if they took the time to look at those calories, was the amount for whatever they ate, whether they ate one serving as identified by the package or whether they ate the whole package and, in fact, there were supposed to be five servings in there. They did not make that connection between the fact that the calories are directly linked to the serving size. So changing the serving size to reflect what people typically eat and then the calories being so front and bold, it's going to make it easier for them because that's how they're currently interpreting the label, which is not correct.
What about fat? We've had this obsession with fat on labels and 0% yogurt and 0% fat in all kinds of things, and yet we are continuing with this obesity epidemic.
Right, right. Part of the problem is there's been such an emphasis on fat intake and the different types of fats, the good fats, the bad fats, that we've really lost touch with that concept that a calorie is a calorie. You know, whether the calories are coming from fat, whether the calories are coming from protein, or whether the calories are coming from carbohydrate, sugar. A calorie is a calorie, and we're consuming excess calories regardless of where they're coming from, whether it's coming from fat, sugar, carbohydrate, protein, whatever. The calories are the bottom line when it comes to weight management. And actually, you'll notice that concept is also changed on the new label. There used to be a line that said calories from fat on the Nutrition Facts label.
Mm-hmm.
That is being removed because we found that it misconveyed a message that, oh, if you just track your fat intake, then you don't have to worry about those other calories. And that's not the case. We need to track all of the calories.
Now, in these 20 years since this label's, since we've had this label, have our ideas about fat changed?
Yeah, I would say there has been some change in what we've learned through the research and the literature about fat. And, you know, there is still very much a link between saturated fat intake and trans fat intake and risk for cardiovascular disease. But we've also learned a lot more about those good fats, those monounsaturated fats, those polyunsaturated fats. And so, you know, we actually went from a point of thinking the less fat, the better, to, okay, moderate amounts of fat, but, you know, also looking at the types of fat. So that's why we need to update. What have we learned? What does research now tell us we need to do as far as nutrient intake specifically related to fat? And so the label is being modified to reflect that as well.
Mm-hmm. And we also know more. For instance, Ruth, you may be able to eat more fat than I may be able to eat, so just as an individual in my genes, right?
Right. And, you know, we're not to the point of doing genetic testing to have individualized diet plans for each and every person, but that is one of the things that you've seen, you know, for a long period of time, it was no more than 30% of your calories should be coming from fat. Well, that's even changed, and it's gone up to 35% because of this new research about, you know, the role of the monounsaturated fats, the polyunsaturated fats, and if your diet has more of those good fats in it, yeah, you can actually have more fat in your diet, and specifically our genetic profile also influences our ability to metabolize and utilize our nutrients maybe a little bit differently. And so the recommendations that are out there are for the general public, but at some point in time we might actually get to genetic testing and personalized diet recommendations.
Wouldn't that be interesting? If you just joined us, nutritionist Ruth Litchfield is with me of Iowa State University, talking about the labels we're to expect in the coming months, maybe a year away, the first time they've been overhauled in 20 years. What other changes should we look for on those labels when they do come out, Ruth?
Okay. Another thing that has been added to the label is there's now a category referred to as added sugars. If you look back over the past 10, 15 years, a lot of organizations, whether it's the Dietary Guidelines for Americans or the American Diabetes Association or the American Heart Association, has always mentioned, you know, trying to limit your intake of added sugars. Well, what is an added sugar? Because on the label previously, it just said sugar. And we need to keep in mind that there are naturally occurring sugars in our food. So, for example, fruit has naturally occurring sugar. Milk has naturally occurring sugar in it. But then we also have added sugar that is added to the product during processing, whether it's being added for flavor or it might be added as a preservative function. And we tend, as Americans, to get too much of these added sugars. A lot of our convenience and our processed prepared foods will have a lot of added sugar. And many times, you know, that's adding calories again. So on the labels now, they're differentiating between total sugar in the product and then what has been added, because we want to try and limit the added sugar. We don't want to just add more calories into a product. So now for the first time, we're going to have the ability, for example, in my Raisin Bran cereal.
Mm.
In my Raisin Bran cereal, I've got naturally occurring sugar because the raisins have natural sugar in them. However, some brands of Raisin Bran cereal actually put sugar coating on the outside of the raisin, and they also might add some sugar to the flakes. Well, now I'm going to be able to tell between my two different versions of Raisin Bran which one has more added sugar, and I want to maybe opt for the one that has less added sugar. The same would be true of if I'm comparing maybe a canned or a frozen fruit product. you know, are they adding some sugar there for preservative effect, or is it being added even more for a flavor aspect? So I can look at the label and compare my different versions of fruit products and try to limit the amount of added sugar by choosing the product with less added sugar.
What about vitamins on our labels? Have they gone through? Are they going through an overhaul too?
Yes. There's also a change on which vitamins are going to be required on the label. So in the past, we've had vitamins A and vitamin C on the label. And those are going to be swapped out. And now we're adding vitamin D and potassium. The reason that this has occurred is if you look at the dietary intakes of Americans, the four most common nutrients that are going to be deficient in the American's diet are going to be calcium, potassium, vitamin D, and fiber. So out of those four nutrients of concern, those that we're most likely to be deficient in, our current label only has information on two of them. And so that's why they're changing what's on the labels to reflect what are the nutrients of concern in today's diet. And so we're taking the vitamin A and C off, and we're putting on potassium and vitamin D.
I wonder, Ruth, if there's any scientific underpinning that this will have any effect. For instance, is there any evidence that having calories printed more prominently will alter people's eating habits?
You know, and I'm not aware of specific research out there to suggest that, because that hasn't been the case. And I think to see if it actually is going to have an impact is going to be something definitely that we need to track and monitor. I think the idea is on the right track. I think where we need to emphasize and streamline the information that we provide to consumers, it's important. Whether this will have an impact, I think, remains to be seen.
As a nutritionist, will you guess? Will you go out on a limb and say it will have some sort of effect on people's choices?
You know, I definitively cannot say it will, but my gut feeling would be the fact that the calories are so front and center, they are so bold, and they are in the amount that is more typically consumed by Americans, that I do believe it's going to influence some changes in choices and food consumption patterns. Can I say that definitively? No. But I really do think it is so prominent that it's going to make people, you know, stand up and take a second notice of what they're making for their choices based on the calories mm-hmm. on that label.
Do you happen to know, have any idea how many of us consumers, food consumers, actually even look at labels?
You know, it was interesting. I did pull out a report that was done by the International Food Information Council, and they kind of do a on-the-street consumer survey of what people are thinking and doing relative to food and nutrition topics. And just in the 2013 survey that they did across the country, the first piece of information that most Americans use on the food labeling is the expiration date. 82% of Americans use the expiration date, but the Nutrition Facts Panel is the second most commonly used source of information. About 67% of people are using the Nutrition Facts Panel. Now, interestingly, though, of those that are using that information, about half of them are looking at the serving size and the amount per container and the ingredient list. So that makes you kind of wonder, so what are they looking at?
Right.
And it was interesting that 97% said they look for information on sugar. So the fact that we're adding this added sugar designation, I think, will be useful, because that actually was the most popular thing that people were looking at, was the sugars, and then came in calories, total fat, fiber, and sodium.
Yeah, sodium, we haven't talked about that. Has that changed? Because I know a lot of people key on the salt intake they have.
Right. And so sodium is still going to be on the label, but a proposed change is that they will modify that percent daily value, or, you know, what percent of the recommended amount. The current DV is based on 2,400 milligrams. The most recent recommendations put out by the Institute of Medicine are either 1,500 or 2,300 milligrams, depending on who you are. So people over the age of 51, people who have already been diagnosed with high blood pressure or they're pre-hypertensive, certain ethnic groups, folks who already have diabetes or some other type of chronic disease, all of those folks are encouraged to shoot for that 1,500 milligram because they're already at risk for hypertension, high blood pressure, and other chronic diseases. And it's estimated that over half of the population should be at that 1,500 milligram recommendation, not the 2,300. So there's a debate on whether we should base it on that 2,300 or the 1,500 based on our population demographics.
Ruth, when can we expect the new labels?
Well, keep in mind that the current proposal out there is open for a 90-day comment period. So any consumer or any business or industry that is got a vested interest in this can post comments. At that point, the FDA will look at all those comments and then come out with the final rules, which may not be until next winter or very early, maybe 2015. But keep in mind that it's going to take time by the food industry to switch over. There's a lot of change on this label. There's three new nutrients being added to the label. They're going to have to go through all of their product lines to make sure they've got the appropriate numbers for the new requirements on the label. They run their labels 12, 18 months in advance of their actual production schedule. So it could be a couple years, 2-3 years before we actually see these labels actually on the shelf.
Okay. Ruth Litchfield, Associate Professor and Associate Chair of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University. Thanks for the explanations.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.